Before we get started, the podcast that you're about to hear was recorded by us on Tuesday, April 29th. On Wednesday, April 30th, there were some important media reports relevant to these topics that we wanted to share with you. It doesn't change our view about the path forward and the opportunities that both companies and the government might have to work together along that path.
Yeah, so we're coming down into the last 2 weeks before the AI diffusion rule kicks in. There's a lot of discussion within the halls of different parts of government in terms of how these modifications are going to take form. Potentially, the three-tiered system of countries may go away. There may be country-to-country negotiations that become part of this, which would fit in with the pattern that we're seeing with the Trump administration and dealing on the tariff side as well. But in the end of the day, it looks like the AI diffusion rule is probably going to go ahead. There's still important national security aspects of it that no matter how it gets modified are still going to remain.
Brent, the core idea that we share in this podcast and the path that we propose that both companies and the government should consider is driven by this idea that the current diffusion framework is designed to incentivize companies and countries who might find themselves in this middle tier that we describe in the podcast to adopt security measures, to adopt a commitment to comply with U.S. expectations in order to get upgraded into tier one under this three-tier approach. What we're seeing is there's a possibility that instead of the world being divided into three tiers, there might just be bilateral agreements between the U.S. government and each country on a country-by-country basis. We feel that our recommendations and our observations still hold. We don't expect for 1 second that even if there is an agreement with a particular country to allow them to import more AI capability, that agreement wouldn't be subjected to the same types of security, export control, and outbound investment restrictions that exist under the current AI diffusion framework. Whatever the overall approach is, the whole point is to restrict the ability of China and other actors to easily access that technology. There will still be an expectation that companies in countries who reach agreements with the United States to access this technology at a greater scale will still be needing to make these commitments. That leads to the opportunity that we're about to identify and explain, where U.S.-based design companies and manufacturing companies might have interesting incentives to work with potential customers in those countries to help them meet these expectations. It might be in those U.S. companies' interest to help them do so and to do so more quickly than they might do otherwise if they were left to their own devices and left on their own to negotiate with the U.S. government exactly how they were going to meet those standards. So, Brent, this is one of those reasons we timestamp things. It is Wednesday, April 30th, just before midnight, heading into Thursday of May 1st.
We have your way forward.
And we're about to explain how. Welcome back yet again to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I am the co-chair of Hughes, Hubbard & Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group. With me is my good friend Brent Carlson, a director of the Berkeley Research Group. Brent, how are we doing?
Great. Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here as always.
Great to see you, Brent. It is Tuesday, April 29th, just before 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern. So, Brent, there's a lot of talk about the AI diffusion framework. Why is it coming up now, and what's all the discussion about?
May 15th is the day where the compliance kicks in and goes into effect. It's caused a lot of discussion, both in the halls of government and in industry. Industry's been pushing back on it quite a bit, but it looks like it's going to go through. There may be some modifications, but it looks like it's going to go ahead. And so this has some important implications for companies and government.
For anyone who might not remember, this was the policy that the Biden administration pushed through the week before Inauguration Day. It was very controversial that they did so. There were reports and allegations that, unlike prior rules, there was not a lot of consultation, if any, with the industry beforehand. It was announced not as a notice of proposed rulemaking or even advance notice, but as an interim final rule. And we've seen this happen before, where the government believes that to preview the rule would cause stockpiling or other anticipatory acts to occur that would really reduce the effectiveness of the rule. Brent, what's striking to you about this rule in particular?
Well, it's how it got rushed out, right? In the last days of the Biden administration, right before inauguration for the new Trump administration, pushing it out without that traditional process of consulting with industry reflects that the government is really concerned, and they're concerned for the stated reasons in the rule itself right up front, which are national security concerns. There are some very serious national security concerns by the United States government here. We're not talking about mainstream gaming PCs or consumer hardware, but these are applications for weapons of mass destruction, WMD, which they put right up in there. AI is in the middle of not just the commercial technologies and applications of the future, but it's also in military as well. It's right in the middle. The country that leads in AI is going to be the one that's also going to be leading in defense and military capabilities as well. So this is a top priority and the stakes are high. But I think for both industry and government, although they've been at locking horns on this, there's an opportunity for both here. And I think this is where we say we have your path.
Exactly. There's a lot of conflict over this. People from both sides of the debate raising very serious concerns about what has been wrought by this rule, and think there were probably some expectations, including based on the testimony of some now confirmed officials in the Department of Commerce, that the rule would at least be given a second look. As somebody recently said at a conference, though, a second look doesn't mean it's going to be better for industry. This is also coming in the context and really on the heels of the April 1st report to the president by the Secretary of Commerce, as requested under the America First Trade Policy, about export control loopholes and recommendations to close them. Now, that report still is not public. We've seen only an April 3rd executive summary that didn't give much detail, but again did reiterate this simpler, stronger, and more effective idea that could be broader and even more impactful in industry, not necessarily narrower. Is there some common ground? Is there actually a way to think about this diffusion rule and how it might work that would show a path forward for both industry and government? Is this a zero-sum rule where one's going to win and the other's going to lose? Or might there be some silver linings, so to speak, in an AI diffusion framework that's really the spirit with which we're approaching this? Brent, let's unpack this one a bit. Where should we start to begin to think about whether there's some common ground here that might actually benefit both parties?
Let's take a look at the locking of horns between industry and government over this. Geopolitically, the world has just totally changed, and it continues to change. It's no longer a simple fight between purely commercial interests and national security interests on the part of the government. There's a way forward where we can get a win-win here and look for these opportunities, but also addressing these national security concerns. Instead of pining away for a world that has already gone, recognize that, step in front of it, and the successful companies that do that will grow their business in this new environment. But why don't we talk about the diffusion rule a little bit, how it stacks up, and where we see this developing into both the carrot and the stick, really.
This harkens back to a framework the Allied powers applied in the First World War. They were trying to restrict the imports by Germany of coal, steel, other critical inputs for the war effort by first requiring exporters to show end-use certificates and to get clearance. Now, the Allies had the navies to enforce this blockade, but they found this to be very difficult, time-consuming, and frankly ineffective, especially when in that war you had not only Switzerland, but also the Netherlands as neutral powers who continued to trade with Germany. Right. Eventually, what the Allies adopted was called the rationing system. They said, you know what? We don't care what you say, what this is going for, or to whom you say this is going to. We know pre-war, in peacetime, what the Netherlands and Switzerland would need in terms of these raw materials. We know even what peacetime Germany would need in terms of these materials. You can continue, Netherlands and Switzerland, to import those quantities. But beyond that, we're going to stop everything. And we don't care what it is. The quota system that we see here in the AI diffusion rule is very similar to this. There's an excellent report, Brent, by Bharath Harithas from the Center for Strategic and International Studies on this framework. This is a 200-plus page rule. I like the way that he's thinking about it and how he describes it. Now, there's three tiers. There's tier one, a sort of inner circle of countries that cooperate on intelligence, close NATO allies, and a few heavyweights in the semiconductor space. Those are essentially unregulated.
There are also universal validated end users, which could be Amazon and Microsoft, that are American companies that can also build data centers around the world. At the other end of the spectrum is Tier 3, China and other embargoed countries, which are subject still to very strict restrictions. In the middle is this Tier 2 category. For these countries, there are per country caps that would apply to every company in those countries, except companies can apply to be a national validated end user, which would greatly increase what they can import and free them from this country-specific quota that they would otherwise be subject to. It creates some interesting incentives that we'll talk about for those Tier 2 countries and the companies in them.
I like how this report puts these Tier 1, 2, 3 in the terms of first class, coach, and no ticket. I think it's a great way to describe them. It's a hint in terms of how we can upgrade our coach tickets to maybe premium plus or maybe business class. It's not going to be first class, but there's some things we can do to upgrade ourselves, help other people upgrade themselves. And that's where some of the opportunities lie. Before we get into the opportunities, I thought it'd be interesting to explore the enforcement mechanisms or levers that are also embedded in this. We've talked about and wrote about this a lot. It's the full definition of knowledge. We've got our article that's on the cover of this month's World ECR magazine about the glass onion concept and how the full definition of knowledge, which includes an awareness of a high probability, initially may look complex, but actually it's quite clear and transparent once understood. Why don't we talk a little bit about the high probability standard as the new national security paradigm and an enforcement lever that the U.S. government could apply in this new situation.
Brent, as professionals who have been working in the world of U.S. extraterritorial enforcement for two decades, this is a really striking assertion of that authority. Essentially, the requirements to be a national validated end user are that you agree to subject yourself voluntarily to several of these new national security controls that the U.S. has adopted within the last year, all of which have, as you say, this new national security paradigm. We wrote in Bloomberg Law about this trend and its importance. All of these turn on the definition of knowledge. All of them define knowledge to include actual knowledge and the high probability standard of knowledge. If you want to be a national validated end user, you have to agree to follow the Treasury Department's new outbound investment rule from the end of October that restricts the investments you can make primarily in Chinese companies. If you want to be a national validated end user, you have to voluntarily subject yourself to whatever ICTS rules the Department of Commerce comes up with and implements. ICTS is the Information and Communication Technology and Services suite of rules to protect American domestic industry from hardware and software that would be subject to potential control by foreign adversaries. When you read and listen in American political discourse to fear that an adversarial power will suddenly control all of our electric vehicles while we're driving, that's what this is meant to address. There are proposed rules related to unmanned vehicles, drones, which if your country is developing those and you're also participating in that industry in your country, this could restrict from where you could source the components of those drones.
You can see how the U.S. government has been setting the stage for more enforcement through a simpler and more effective approach by leveraging the full definition of knowledge and the high probability standard. There's a great quote from Gregory Allen at CSIS about enforcement.
Gregory Allen is really on the forefront of AI issues, not only on the regulation, but also just on the national security policy aspects of it and the technical capability of it. We are both avid listeners of his AI policy podcast and recommend that to anyone who also wants to really dig deep into these issues. He recently did a report on DeepSeek and very diligently teased out what exactly do we know about what happened? What exactly do we know about how they achieved the outcomes they reported? What do we think we know about how they obtained and when they obtained the hardware to be able to do this? On the importance of the enforcement of existing U.S. export controls. He says, quote, "Of all the choices available, the worst policy choice that the U.S. government could make is to regulate aggressively, but with large loopholes and weak enforcement. Such an approach incurs nearly all the cost of an aggressive export control policy, but does so without providing any of the possible strategic benefits in terms of slowing Chinese progress in semiconductors and AI." This is Gregory Allen's one-way policy fallacy. Maybe that's better name would be Gregory Allen's empty policy hazard. We'll try to check in with him and see what she prefers. But it's very insightful because we know that many, many people and boards and C-suites and in the trade compliance functions at some of the most important American companies that we have are running around doing Herculean tasks, trying to get on top of export controls compliance and trying to do the right thing. Whether or not we enforce the laws, we're telling them they have to do this. But if we don't enforce the laws, especially regarding smugglers, resellers, and distributors who might be lying to those companies about what they're doing, then we're not relieving them of those tasks, but we're also not actually doing anything to limit China's ability to progress in this space, to get the semiconductors they need in order to compete with us effectively in the AI space. The common point connecting all these things is that enforcement can be more effective if the U.S. continues the trend we saw in July with guidance from BIS, in August with an enforcement action by BIS, in December in a report from the majority staff of the Senate PSI, and fully leverages the high probability standard and the way it enforces this law. It gets around these smugglers, these distributors, these resellers claiming that they don't really actually know anything or putting their heads in the sand, while at the same time empowering trade compliance professionals at American companies to adopt a corresponding and complementary risk-based approach in their own compliance function. So you don't have to zero risk everything, but you do have to design and then execute on a strategy for identifying what criteria drive risk that we control or that we can independently verify. Then within this framework that the companies can develop, making subjective decisions in a consistent, repeatable, and documented way about where are the parties that we're going to look at more closely and what other ones are we less worried about. If the government embraces that standard, and if companies are enabled to embrace that standard, companies would be better able to comply with export controls, and the government would be able to better enforce the export controls. The result would be a response to the Gregory Allen one-way policy fallacy. Maybe we'll call it the high probability corollary, where there will always be things you miss, but the effectiveness of export controls goes up, the loopholes go down because you're targeting the people at most risk for creating and exploiting loopholes. And there is a strategic benefit to the U.S. government by working hand in hand with companies to accomplish this.
Just to take a look at what are the pressures driving it from the U.S. government side, there's very strong bipartisan support to address these national security issues. This comes right up front in the AI diffusion rule. To quote, as the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has assessed, AI models have the potential to enable advanced military and intelligence applications, lower the barriers to entry for non-experts to develop weapons of mass destruction, support powerful offensive cyber operations, and assist in human rights violations, such as through mass surveillance. I think that right up front should get everyone's attention, especially around the WMD, the weapons of mass destruction, because in the EAR, that kicks in catch-all provisions, don't they?
It does. And you have several catch-all provisions that could apply to those things, whether it's UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, ballistic missiles, hypersonic missiles that would fall into some of those categories, supercomputers, which is another catch-all that we've seen referenced to recently as something the government's stressing. These are serious risks. You could take the view of a skeptic and say, well, you know, the government isn't sharing with us the classified intelligence that is informing those conclusions. One way to look at that, though, especially as a company in the private sector or as advisors in the private sector, is it doesn't really matter what you think. If the government thinks that, and especially when you see people across the political spectrum think that, and across different branches of government think that, it's not crazy to assume that at least they have information that forms a consensus view about this. They're going to act as if this is true, and that compels us to respect that they're going to act that way.
These issues ain't going to go away. These underlying issues are strong. Recognize that, and let's see where these opportunities are. Is the glass half full? Is it half empty? Where can we gain out of this? Mike, you and your colleagues had a great client advisory that came out on helping middle-tier countries and companies in there to upgrade themselves so they can go from a coach ticket to premium plus, a business class. This is classic business development 101, where for the company selling into those, we're helping to build that market, which is going to be sustainable.
Yeah, Brent, we didn't have the eloquence to use the first class, coach, and no ticket metaphor that Bharath Harithas did from CSIS, which again was a great way to think about this. But we were thinking in writing that alert, okay, I'm a company in a tier two country. I'm devastated. I'm going to look at all these tier one countries and my competitors in those countries, and I'm just going to watch them exponentially outpace me unless I'm willing to just give up to Amazon or Microsoft or whoever might qualify as a universal validated end user. We wanted to define the path that people could take to see the silver lining perhaps in this and to take what opportunities there are really to become champions for their own countries in the development of this new technology that's critical and expected to be critical for essentially every aspect of human life, not just national defense or national security. What are the things you can do? Well, walk through in particular, supplement 10 to the AI diffusion rule, lists a lot of the expectations, and it's a punch list. Go through the punch list. There are physical security requirements, cybersecurity requirements. We mentioned already the requirements to essentially comply with the same laws and restrictions about outbound investment and inbound controls that U.S. companies would have to comply with. If you really are serious about positioning yourself to make the most out of this opportunity, all of these things turn on the high probability standard. And there's a significant commitment, very significant commitment that is needed in order to meet the standards to be a national validated end user. But now's the time to start. For companies that are designing or manufacturing the chips that they could then sell to these national validated end users, there's a real opportunity to assist them with becoming validated. There may be things where they need to cooperate with the manufacturers and design companies in order to really effectively manage this.
There are some big markets that we're talking here too. There's India, Israel, Singapore, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. These are some great opportunities in this space if it's done right.
Right. If a company qualifies as a national validated end user, it's more than six times the per country cap of AI chips that they could import into their country just for them. So there's huge opportunities and huge upside there that would be well worth everyone's investment. I understand why people are highlighting dangers and risks of the rule. We totally get that. But assuming on May 15th that the rule is essentially unchanged, this is your plan B. This is your fallback strategy. This is a glass half full approach to take rather than a glass half empty. And it may seem a bit trite when we're talking about the billions of dollars at stake and the national security issues that have been flagged as being relevant to this, but all that we can control is what we do. And if you're not able to control what the AI diffusion rule becomes, and it remains essentially as announced as an interim final rule, okay, now it's time to pivot. Where are the opportunities here? Where are the new markets really that the design and manufacturing companies could create in collaboration with their customers in those countries?
It's really important to go back to the national security considerations. The reasons behind these are real. These are not a nice to have. It's a need to have.
You know, that's right, Brent. I mean, look, without getting too dramatic about it, there are military planners in both China and the United States whose job is to prepare now for what might happen in the event of a conflict. A lot of people are working really hard to make sure we don't get to that point, and that would be very bad for everyone involved. But that is the reality of what people are planning for. Those people are looking at this technology and these capabilities and really having concerns about allowing the free, uninhibited flow of these technologies and capabilities to someone they perceive to be an adversary. Are they requiring or expecting it to be 100% effective? No. But if it's zero or close to zero, that's a huge problem. I think there's some way they can work with industry to get to a point and find that path where, to address Gregory Allen's very valid concerns, enforcement and compliance rise to the level to have the necessary strategic impact to best protect our interests. Well, after nine episodes, Brent, of Red Flags Rising here at the end of the 10th, listeners are clamoring for yet another segment of Brent Carlson's Managing Up. Brent, we've talked about the path forward and the mindset necessary to find that path today. In light of what we've discussed, what is your Managing Up lesson today?
Every cloud has a silver lining. Every challenge brings new opportunities. So instead of trying to fight the tide, ride the wave. National security and commercial success can go hand in hand. And together, we can find a path.
Well said, Brent. You know, people might be wondering, why have we been emphasizing the silver lining, the glass half full, the path forward? We were listening to some remarks by Secretary of Commerce Howard Lutnick on a podcast. He talked about the importance of having a vision for a particular policy objective and then charting the path to reach that objective, doing the homework, laying the groundwork, rolling up the sleeves and figuring out what is the best path to get to that objective, then going to leadership and then executing it. And that's really what inspired us to think about what is the path here. So many people, for good reason, are very intently focused on the AI diffusion framework, the impact on our country, the impact on our companies, the impact on their customers, the impact on allies. These are serious issues that are very appropriately getting a lot of attention. But it seemed to us worth spending the time to unpack the actual proposed rule a bit, to think about opportunities that might present, again, assuming it comes into effect on May 15th. And if the objective is to promote allies and frankly, to look at this as a way to build capacity and scale in friendly countries, how might business and the government, industry and the Department of Commerce work together to find those opportunities and take advantage of them?
Definitely. We have your path.
Well, Brent, if anyone listening is interested in exploring that path with us or picking our brains on the path or just comparing notes over a virtual coffee or a real one, our contact information is in the show notes. Brent, that concludes our latest episode of Red Flags Rising. I have a feeling we'll have a lot to talk about in the coming weeks. Again, it's been a pleasure. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.